want to talk a little bit about meditation, and then we'll have some moments of meditation based upon what I'm unfolding here. Oh my gosh. I was just saying these talks are going to be on meditation, these three, this talk. When we're talking Vedanta, when we talk about meditation, it's a little bit different. No, we don't need that on. Do you need it on? Do you need it on?
I guess I don't see what I write, but
okay.
I don't want to read it, right? No, that's fine.
Are you sure?
Yeah,
is it there? Because it's nice not to have the glare since we're going to be going in and out of contemplating.
Oh.
Yeah. Oh. Oh, well, all right. So our whole relationship with meditation is much different than it's kind of the standard understanding of meditation, which really has to do with sitting quietly, perhaps cross-legged or in a comfortable position, and bringing your mind into a state of absorption or into an experiential meditative state. And then there's a lot of different things that are said about that, but that's normally how we think about it. Even as a Vedantin, often you think about meditation, where to sit and meditate. Our word for meditation is actually nididhyasana, in terms of what we're talking about as the sadhana, shravana, manana, nididhyasana, shravana, the sadhana for actually gaining this knowledge. We have sadhana for antakarana shuddhi, purity of mind, mostly karma yoga, types of meditative practices like pranayama, things to control the mind, that type of thing, vipassana. But then we have shravana, which means really exposing yourself to the teaching pramana, between you and your teacher, that guru-sisha relationship in which shravana takes place. Again, now when I say guru-sisha, those are Sanskrit words. They're words that we use. They're very common in India. But here they're words that are a little bit loaded in a Western context that maybe sometimes we're not comfortable. So you have to be careful of these words. Technically, guru means for a person, nobody's walking around as a guru. Guru means the person who removes your self-ignorance. The one who removes the darkness of self-ignorance is the guru. So that's a relational word. And you are the student. The sishya is the student. The guru is the one who's teaching, that wielding that pramana for you in such a way that your ajnanam, your ignorance, is removed. And so, when we say nidhyasana, we're talking about being exposed in a very deep and personal way to this teaching sampradaya, where the Vedanta is being held as a means of knowledge, handled as a means of knowledge, to make you actually see at the time of teaching, to actually at that time recognizing yourself and recognizing the nature of reality. And that's because yourself is here, right? Your mind is here, your sense organs are here, your body is here, and this world that you're experiencing is here. And so there's something that is already present that needs to be discerned. And so the Vedanta is just simply pointing to it so that you can recognize it. Because otherwise, from beginningless time, the relationship I have between myself and my mind and body is one of what we call anyonya adhyasa, mutual superimposition, where I never bother to think of the who am I question doesn't really come up in terms of who am I really. I already have an answer for that in terms of my body, in terms of my mind, in terms of my job, in terms of my relations, in terms of my friends. I can answer it in all kinds of ways. That really the who am I question doesn't necessarily come up at all. But for somebody for whom it does come up, that person is on their way to becoming a mumukshu, somebody who really wants and needs to gain this knowledge. Like, it's very uncomfortable to realize you don't have a clue, really, who you are or what's going on here. You know, and how to fulfill myself, how to become a whole person. Then a person starts to become a mumukshu, and then as the laws, so universal laws, according to the Vedanta, will say at that time, you meet your teacher, and at that time, you'll find yourself becoming very involved in a committed way to the whole Upanishadic Sampradaya, that teaching tradition that unfolds over and over again in so many ways, your own nature. So you see it every time in class. You should see it. You see it, and you see it, and then you see it again, and you see it again a little bit more deeply. And then as you're seeing it, questions come up that are then, actually it's the most natural way, but it seems uncanny at the time. It's being unfolded, and your question comes up, and the next thing the teacher does is deal with that question. It's because there's logical flows, and your mind is logical, you know. And so in the whole unfoldment, it's like that. So you start seeing more and more deeply, and then your mind starts having, can have other types of questions that are not, what does the Vedanta say? What do the Upanishads say? Who am I really? What are the Upanishads telling? Then there's the other type of questions that come up, like, yeah, but why couldn't it be like this? Why does it have to be like that? That's called manana. Shravana is where I'm exposing myself really to seeing this. The pramana is being wielded, the means of knowledge is being wielded. I'm seeing. Manana is where I'm having some doubts. Yeah, but it could be like this, couldn't it? In the Mandukya Upanishad, the whole fourth chapter is taking some of the major philosophical objections to Vedanta at the time of that writing, especially the Sankhya Yoga and the Vaisheshikas and the Bauddha, and just putting forward what they have to say and then answering it. Because they stand, all of those type of darshanas and objections could as well be yours. It's couched in a philosophical system, but your mind could have those same thoughts. Well, why couldn't it be like this? Or why couldn't it be like that? And then when that type of questioning is there, you don't have clarity, you don't have nishta, where your mind is really, really settled. And so manana is very, very important. And so shravana and manana. But then say the clarity is there, you do know who you are. You have recognized, you know, and you don't have doubts either. But you have what we call viparita bhavana. Viparita bhavana means by, I know, but I act like I don't. That my emotional state is still based in that, like a habitual, it's habitual, you know. So the habit of that those habitual reactions and habitual identifications needs some special attention, and that's what we call nididhyasana. Nididhyasana can translate as contemplation or meditation, but the problem is that my viewpoint of meditation can be very constricted to sitting cross-legged with my eyes closed, where actually nididhyasana takes place throughout the day. It can take place in reference to any given thought, you know. And so it's also helpful to sit in contemplation, especially when the teacher have guided contemplations that just hold, like a guided contemplation, will just hold your mind in that knowledge, kind of in slow motion, pointing it out, helping to put your mind into an absorbed state, do all kinds of preparatory work in the guided meditation, for instance, relaxing the body, inner child work. That's all preparatory. Working with your attitudes toward friends, relations, relatives in the waking state. You know, those are all preparatory practices that help to bring your mind into a relaxed, and your unconscious, not just your mind, your unconscious, into a much more deeply relaxed state. You know? And all of those type of preparatory things that we do, like the inner child work and also inner dialogue with people that I'm having difficulty with, the different types of guided meditations we do, that also is something that becomes, can be done all the time, anytime. You know, different practices that have to do with resolving psychological tensions and stresses and hurts that I'm having in my relationship with my own mind, my own unconscious, and with the world. We teach a lot of different techniques and methods for resolving, you know, and being able to handle those things. Well, all of those techniques are based in your knowledge. What they're doing is bringing your buddhi, your mind, into a state of welcoming both inner and outer situations, inner and outer people, inner and outer little ones, parents, employers, lovers and ex-lovers, all of the people that and situations in our past and present that cause us pain in one way or another. If I say causes pain, they cause us pain in terms of I find myself trying to get away or to reject or to resist, and they bring about a lot of tension in the mind, in my mind. So I work on, as kind of a sadhana, different attitudes of acceptance and welcoming, so that even though that particular person or that particular situation causes stress and pain in the manas, in the mind, I find that I can welcome that stress or welcome that pain. Like I can have an inner attitude of, say, the little one inside is hurt. It's easy for me to have, maybe easier than an adult in the world, to say, that's okay, you can be with me. Like if I had a little baby that is crying, they would pick the baby up and hold the baby and say, it's okay, it's okay. Because even if the baby were to kick me in the face, you know, scream and poop all over me, you know, I wouldn't mind at all. Because it's the baby, it's my little baby, you know, it would be fine. And if it kicked me in the face, it would become villainous. And if it pooped on me, it would become outrageous or threw up all over me as I was burping it. Like if it throws up all over me, and then I think, what kind of a child? Not gonna happen, right? Not gonna happen. You know? So I can, it's easy, really, for me to, easier to invoke that type of love and care and depth and understanding toward my little ones inside, if I even know to do that. So part of the, when we're talking about meditation, it's going to include gaining that skill so that that's natural. Natural in this way, that becomes, this is something that becomes habitual. It's just something that you naturally do. Like, for instance, if you feel emotional pain or some hurt inside, some reaction inside, well, normally, before you have knowledge or some depth of understanding, you engage with it externally, with the person who has hurt you, or, you know, this person has done this to me, or you've really hurt me, or how could you say such a thing? It just becomes like an external hurt that I'm trying to fix with this person. But what you learn to do before doing that, you might not end up doing that, but before doing that, you learn to just naturally go to the hurt itself, where your mind goes and it holds the hurt. It says, what's really going on? I can be with that hurt. I can hold that hurt. That's huge. It's very simple, but I don't know to do that. Once I know to do it, it makes such a difference in my life to be able to go and be with that hurt in a loving way, you know? Or if I've lost my temper, or I've done something that, you know, I would really choose not to do, I can be a friend to that person who just blew it, that part of myself that just blew it. It's okay. We'll make it up. We'll do better next time. Don't worry about it. Because it's not my value, but I'm not always able to live out my values. I do my best. But see, that I do my best gives so much room. That's a friend. I do my best and we'll do better next time. That means your buddhi is a friend, you know, that gives you the benefit of the doubt. The buddhi often is not a friend. It often doesn't give the benefit of the doubt. Like if you blew it, you can feel so down on yourself and so sick about yourself and have self-hatred. You know, many people have a lot of self-hatred. And so to learn how to evoke, you know, love and kindness and benefit of the doubt like you would for your friends, that's a huge thing. Makes a big difference, you know. So these things are kind of essential parts of meditation. Why? Because even in terms of the external relationships, you know, if I hate somebody, try to meditate when you hate somebody. It doesn't work, you know. You're trying to do an emotional bypass that doesn't take place. There's a little one inside that is so hurt, you know, you try to meditate. And that little one is saying, what about me? What about me? What about me? That means it needs attention first. If there's somebody out here that has really hurt you and you just can't stand them, you know, and your mind is suffering that affect of hatred or dislike, and you try to meditate, you can do things like pranayama or something to try to bypass, but that's really all you're doing. You're bypassing. It will work for a minute, you know, but when the pranayama wears off, then the same thing's there. So then we have to learn how to bring a different attitude, you know, toward all beings, including the person that evokes these negative feelings for us. So we have meditations for that, where you can just welcome that person and in your mind just have them there, you know, and evoking all of those feelings and just say, I'm fine to have those feelings. Don't push them away. I can be with those feelings. And it's very interesting to evoke something that's very painful for you and to accept it. And that means your buddhi, well, the painful knot is there. And so now internally you're free in reference to that person because this terrible affect that's associated with that image has dissipated because you're not resisting it and you're saying it's okay. You know, you can say that to your side of it, but if you say you're full of hate, it's okay, you could be with me. And you can accept all of that rage and hate and hurt, right? Hatred, the hatred and dislike and the... But really, those are just super anger. Those are superficial defenses, really. What's always underneath is a lot of hurt, you know. And so instead of being judgmental about these emotions, you know, it's much more effective to just accept them. Accept them means welcome them, as opposed to pushing them away or trying to take retaliation on whoever's causing it. It's a whole different, and it's kind of counterintuitive. Knowledge is totally counterintuitive because ajnana makes you do the opposite of what you're supposed to do. So we have lifetimes of inappropriate behavior all based upon self-ignorance. That's what, and that inappropriate behavior is beginningless. So we have lots of it. We have lots of it. Yeah. And so now we find ourselves continually doing, learning to do the opposite, you know. But I think one of the greatest sadhanas is learning how to be in the present with Ishvara, with what is, and saying, okay, you can, whatever it is, whoever it is, you're welcome to be here with me. I don't mean in that in an ego-y way, but there's, you're all welcome to be with me. I don't mean it like that. It's that we can have resistance and push away our experience and the people that are in our life, all based on raga dvesha, all based on our likes and dislikes. You know, I like you and I like you and I like you because I don't have any resistance or pain when you're around. But I don't like you and I don't like you and I don't like you because when you're around, I'm really uncomfortable in one way or another. You know, So what if I don't accept that? This is like how Swamiji is. Anyway, if he had something like that, he would immediately know, I don't accept that. I'm not going to be like that. No, I will accept everything. It doesn't mean that you act out on everything, but you accept as Ishvara what the creation is giving you and all of the people that are in your life, you know. You welcome them. I say welcome because welcoming has so much love in it. Welcoming is the opposite, like, of rejecting. Yeah, you know. So you don't say, oh, sure, you're welcome to come in. That's not welcome. You know, that's rejecting. So welcoming, there's heart in it. There's love in it. It's fine. These are sadhanas. But these sadhanas, they are based upon your knowledge. And so when these sadhanas are recognized as being based upon your knowledge, every time, and I'll explain that in a minute, every time you're find yourself doing this act of welcoming or inner child work, all of that, when it's based upon your knowledge, then it becomes nididhyasana. It's not separate from nididhyasana. So what's your knowledge? The knowledge that you learn and see at the time of teaching, you know, is that the ananda or love that I seek in life, which is, you have other words, positive words for it, like love and compassion and joy and all the whole positive spectrum are just different forms of love. They're forms that I'm just comfortable in that world. You know, I'm very comfortable if I'm feeling loved. You know, I don't know how to... It's uncomfortable, but really to get a little bit deeper than that, when I'm feeling loved, then I'm really comfortable, you know. Because being loved is the nature of the self. Not loving, you know, it's not a verb, it's not an action, it's a completed state. The self is changeless, it's a completed state. So what is the word within samsara, within duality that we have for that completed state? It's loved. I am loved. And if I am loved, I can be loving. Because the loving has to come from the loved. Myself is loved. I'm a loved person, so I can be loving. What if I feel I'm a hated person, you know, or a miserable person, or a hurt person? It's hard for me to be loving, though I can be, but the loving is coming out of hurt. A hurt person is giving and loving. In fact, this becomes a wound, like a wounded healer. But when that wounded healer is trying to be loving, there's the wounded part of the wounded healer also gets healed by that act of being loving. Because when you're loving someone, you also feel loved. So it helps you get back to that essential, your essential nature. So what about when I realize that my essential nature is the very loved being that I'm always seeking in the creation? And that, in fact, all of these raga dvesha, all of these likes and dislikes are just illusory. As though this object has some special love on it, that it's beaming at me. And this one over here, it's beaming at me some hatred. As though these objects in the world actually contain any of this. Or that the world contains it. It doesn't contain it at all. That's why Swami, there's so many stories that we tell that the basic ones, say one person is the loved person, okay? Is we have to just get grounded in your experience, okay? If the loved person walks in the door, then we all feel loved because that loved person is beaming, is like a loved light bulb. The loved light bulb, the light bulb of love walks into the door and we are all illumined by that love, right? But we don't experience life that way. Sometimes a person is the loved light bulb to me, and the hated, dark, burnt-out light bulb to the person right next to me. And to everybody else in the room, nothing. Weren't we just talking about that? Mm-hmm. She gave him the look, too.
Yeah, she told me.
Yeah. Tibby's in class with us tonight. She is on the chair. She's on the couch. She's hardly ever sits in here with us, but here she is, and she's very happy. She's attending the talks on meditation. Okay, so anyway, what I'm saying is there comes a time with your knowledge where you recognize that the source of love is not something externalized, it's your very being. And that just like the graham crackers, you know, the horse graham, the animal crackers, there isn't anything in the box of animal crackers. All of the animals are nothing but graham cracker. Every single animal is only the same graham cracker. And we come more and more to realize that this whole universe is only the one same self, you know? That there is no externalized ananda. It does not exist. You don't ever look at, oh, look at that ananda over there. Look at that love over there. No, you'll say, look at those people. They look so in love. I wish I could be in love like that. Or look at that person who looks so very happy and peaceful. That's how I want to be, you know? You're seeing the markers of it, you know, but you're not experiencing it externally. That's what I'm saying. Somebody has a big smile. Well, I wish I could feel like that, you know. So the loved experience is something internal, not external. You know? And so we have to discover what that is and what makes me feel away from it. But say as my knowledge gets more and more clear, my behavior in the world changes and my value for certain sadhanas change also. Once as I really start to know, why would I want to be disturbed by the world? Why would I want any given person to disturb me when they really have nothing to do with my ananda? They don't own it. They don't have it. They have no say over it whatsoever. What happens when I know that? And when I recognize my own being, the changelessness of my own being, then this habitual ignorance is not something I'm very interested in, you know? Or this running, taking these raga dveshas, these likes and dislikes, seriously, in the sense that do I want to jeopardize my own shanti or my own ananda by engaging in the world in this way, by having my own fullness illumine a lot of pain that is being produced by my way I'm operating in the world. You know? You understand? Like, it's not worth it. Because what I'm doing is producing pain in my mind that is then being held by myself, by my being. My ananda isn't affected in one way or the other. I, with all of my fullness and wholeness, am illumining this very painful state that is taking place because of the way I'm behaving in the world or behaving toward myself, toward my mind. I'm producing very painful states for myself. And those painful states are illumined by me. And so for jnani, it takes some time before you stop producing these painful states, you know, by the way that by your attitudes. But even when you are still producing the painful states, they're not covering the ananda of yourself. Because nothing covers it. But then I get to a place like, why am I relating to the world or even relating to my own mind or my own hurts and pains in such a way as to exacerbate these painful states? Why am I doing that? You know? And that's great when I start thinking like that, because then you're thinking, wow, this is not worth it. It's not worth it for me to get upset with you or to get hurt by you. It's helpful. If I can help, that's helpful. But it's not worth it for me to get into this jiva srishti where I'm doing all kinds of projections, you know, and digging myself into the ground, into pain. And so I stop behaving in that way. And so certain things, as you mature and you're all, I know that all of us are noticing this as we go along. I'm just kind of throwing it out there so that you're actually putting some words to it if you haven't put words to it already. It's a shift, you know, so I'm going to just put the value of values. There's a shift in what I value. And the shift, my value now, is really in line with my knowledge. And so that you're going to notice a lot your direction in life changing. Like, let me give you some examples. And each one of these is a sadhana when it's not happening. For instance, yourself, your being, is not changing. Sometimes in a meditation I'll say, you have no history. There's no history for the self. And there's no future. Because there's no time for your being. You always just simply are. So the wholeness or the ananda, which is really the self of this whole creation, simply is. It's not in a state of becoming. You simply are, you know. So when you realize that, there is nothing for you to improve, and you can't hurt yourself either. So I can't, like, say I know a little bit more, or I do a little bit more, or, you know, I gain a little bit more money, or I get a little bit more popular, or whatever it is. Myself is not gaining more money, and it's not becoming more popular. It's not becoming happier either. And when things aren't going well, you know, it's a hard time, I don't have any money, or things aren't going well, and my family's mad at me, all of these kind of things that happen in life, that's not happening to me. And that's not just words. I actually recognize in my own presence that I remain free. That's what we mean by asanga. Nothing is happening at all. And so then all of this kartritvam, all of this doership and all these things that I think that I need to accomplish, from the standpoint of me, I don't need to accomplish anything and I can't accomplish anything. Not from the standpoint of myself, because I have no history. I'm not subject to time. And so there's no improvement to be gained there. And so then for who, why am I worrying about the future then? Or why it's, I mean, this is actually, can be very mind-boggling, but it's worth thinking. It does shake you up at the roots. You know, why am I worried about what's going to become of me? Because actually nothing's going to become of me. I already am full and complete and free from time. So I'm not going to get anywhere. 20 years from now, I can work my tail off, which is fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But for me, there's no history or future. So nothing's going to be any better in 20 years than it is right now. Nor can it be any better. Right? Because ananda is ananda. What I'm seeking, I already am. So I can't make it better. But even if I thought I could make it better, I can't. Right? So now say I really realize that there's no, even in my own nature, there's no doership. There's no doership at all. Then what am I doing here? What am I worried about? You know, how should I be if you start thinking about having no history and that this body, mind, sense organs, which is here in this world, you know, how should I be here? And I would say, well, that's exactly, you should be here. That's how should you be here? You should be here, you know. Not, you know, imagining into the future. Because for one thing, you are not doing anything. The Atma doesn't do anything. But your mind is imagining into the future as though you're doing something. You're not doing anything. So this Jiva Srishti, this imaginal world that you are making up, is fanciful and usually catastrophic. Because as you imagine into the future what you want, you also, because you're smart, you also recognize all of the obstacles that are going to stop you from getting that. The two go together. I want this, and these are the things that are going to stop me from getting it. Because this isn't Swargaloka. In Swargaloka, the highest heaven world of the heaven worlds within samsara, as you imagine, so it comes, so you get. But this isn't Swargaloka, so here, everything that we want is filled with obstructions and all kinds of reasons why I can't get it. And so as you fantasize, included in the fantasy are the obstructions, and so included in that are all of the emotions that go along, you know, with that worry, right? All kinds of emotions that are presented that have nothing to do with now. All your worries, nothing to do with now. And you know what? At some point, you stop doing it. It becomes a sadhana. When you see your mind doing that, you realize it is totally useless. And you decide, no. I'm going to be here. And there's a lot of understanding in that too. Here is Ishwara. This is Ishwara Srishti. This is, you know, the objective reality that this body, mind, sense organs belongs to this objective reality. It belongs to this story that is taking place. It belongs to my prarabdha karma. That is all Ishwara. So my whole attitude becomes so different. You know, let me be here and see what Bhagavan does. That's my favorite thing. If you look into the future and you know that some decisions are going to have to make, you have no idea how on earth that's going to happen. You have no idea. And so you can either be fretful about it or say, well, let's see what Bhagavan does. Yeah. Let's see what the creation does. Let's see what Ishvara does. How is this problem going to be solved? I have no idea. You know, but I don't have to know. The problems are too complex for us to really know. You're just in an imaginal world. So what if you have that Shraddha in Bhagavan and live here, you know, and appreciating Bhagavan, do what needs to be done moment to moment as your life unfolds. That's what Swamiji lives his whole life that way. It's a great, great thing to understand. Okay, so now, in terms of Nididhyasana, every moment that you recognize that, every moment that you bring your mind back to that recognition, that is Nididhyasana. Every single moment that you do that, every moment throughout the day that your mind comes to rest in your own presence, where your own being, the Atma, the Self, becomes dominant. Dominant means it's something that is acknowledged by the mind. You're always shining there. And as a jnani, you don't really need the mind to say anything. You're always dominant. But in terms of meditation, so in that sense, because I'm self-evident, nobody's lighting me up. I'm lighting everything up. Nobody's lighting me up. In that sense, I'm always meditating. There's never a time that I'm not in samadhi because the self is always present and it's always non-dual and it's always in samadhi. But when we're talking about Nididhyasana from the standpoint of the mind, it's every moment you own up your knowledge that you recognize that this is nothing but Ishvara, or you see it, where your mind comes back to the home base of your own timeless being, changeless being. Even if it's a split second, that split second is Nididhyasana. And so throughout the day, when you're recognizing everything as Ishvara, when you're resolving your raga dvesha, just pulling them back to yourself, that's Nididhyasana. You know? When you're welcoming everything, that's Nididhyasana. Because when you're welcoming everything, you're welcoming it to you, to your being. You know? Even when the buddhi is being kind to the manas, the buddhi is speaking for your being. You know, the Atma doesn't speak, but the buddhi, which is rooted in your own self, because it's relaxed and it's not overwhelmed by raga dvesha, by likes and dislikes, it is like a mirror of yourself, and it's speaking for you. It's speaking for the Atma. And so as you gain some strength in your knowledge, you know, there's no time when the buddhi is away from you. And so it is handling the problems externally and internally. You know, the problems internally or complexes or traumas that happened in childhood and hurts that are inside. Then the buddhi, which is relaxed and in the moment and appreciating Ishvara, because the buddhi is really what's holding your knowledge, then it welcomes those hurt little ones. You know? And the buddhi, then dealing out here in its waking state, with everything is recognizing in the present, living in the present. This is all Ishvara. This person is Ishvara, this person is Ishvara, everything is Ishvara, you know? And so let me do whatever Bhagavan is asking for at this moment. That's the jiva talking, you know, what is being asked of me, this body, mind, sense organs, which is really nothing but Ishvara, you know, the ajnana that's creating, the ignorance that's creating so much problem, you know. What if I'm just not creating a problem? What if this is fine? It's all graham crackers after all, you know. What if this is just fine? I could be here. Like when Swamiji said once, he was in his little kutir in Sandipani Sadhana in Hawaii, where I went to the first course in 1972, sitting in this little kutir. He's just reflecting and he said, you know, I really never have to leave this little place. This is enough for me. I never have to leave it for my whole life. I could just sit here, it would be fine. You know what? Why wouldn't it be fine? Because if you go sit here, it's the same self. If you go sit here, it's the same self. You know? It's a story he told. I've told it here before. I don't know if you've heard this one. But the story is there was this sannyasi, the sadhu, and he was sitting in his in his little kutir. And when people would come in, he would always have his feet resting on Shivalinga. You never do that. And this sadhu, his feet were up, cross-legged, and he was laid back, and Nara's feet were, you know, resting on the Shivalinga. It's totally a dharma. It's totally a huge papa, you know. And so his students and devotees would get upset. You can't have your foot on the, you know, the Shivalinga. Swamiji, Swamiji, you know, please. And so that we'll move you, we'll move you. So they'd take his feet and put it over here. And now there his feet again were on the Shivalinga. And then he would get up and try to move him somewhere else. But there again, his feet would still be on the Shivalinga. They couldn't get his feet off the Shivalinga wherever he was. And he said, how can I ever not be in the Shivalinga? There's nothing but Shiva here, you know? It's just a story they tell. But that's the truth of it, you know? And so this process of us owning up our knowledge moment by moment by moment throughout the day, and then sitting in contemplation just to be with my knowledge, where I don't, it's helpful because I'm being with my knowledge, I'm being with myself, I'm being with what I know. This is Nididhyasana, I'm being with what I know. Because my mind, you know, needs that reinforcement. Because when I walk out the door, I'm bombarded, you know, by all of this habitual way of responding to the world. And so we do Nididhyasana to give our mind a chance just to be with myself and to get used to me, get used to having knowledge, you know. It gives me like a timeout, so I have a daily practice. But what I'm saying with the Shastra Aparoksha Anubhuti, famous text in the last 10 or 15 verses, the Shankara just says, you mean I have to sit? Do I really have to sit and close my eyes to meditate? When am I not meditating? You know, when am I not with myself? That's the truth of it. So there's nothing wrong with sitting and meditating because I'm just taking a time out and enjoying being with the self that I know, you know. Or in class, we always do the Nididhyasanas in a form of guided meditation because it's just bringing the mind, with the help of the teacher, it's just bringing my mind back to myself, you know. But that's not the all of Nididhyasana. You can be studying a text, like studying the Bhagavad Gita, for instance, that will be Nididhyasana because as you study your mind, you're bringing mind back continually to your knowledge. It's that seeing, that act of seeing it. That's what Nididhyasana is. It happens throughout the day, all of the time. For a jnani, you wouldn't say, if you're not in Nididhyasana, there's some sadhana that needs to be done. If you're not in the Nididhyasana natural, then you do some Nididhyasana. Do you know what I mean? So that means to me, it just means sadhana. There's something pulling my mind out. And I'm talking about some weird state where my mind is always inside. No, normal. I'm talking about what is normal. When I'm feeling at home and grounded in my knowledge, it's absolutely normal. It's not a weird state. The weird state is when I'm not, when I'm pulled out, because then I don't feel at home. I can feel isolated or unwanted or unloved or angry or hurt. You know, that's not me. I'm not comfortable with that, because otherwise we'd say, now, whenever you get hurt, you just stay there. Let's foster that hurt. We're not ever saying that. We're healing that hurt. We're healing that anger, you know? Because that, and that's where the sadhana comes in, because those things are not natural for us, and we're not comfortable, and we're not at home, and we don't feel loved, we don't feel cared for. So those things need our help. You know? I think that's exactly what they need. They need our help. Our help means bringing my mind back to the fullness and wholeness that's already there. Because in reality, everything is just fine, you know? And your life, what's so interesting is that your life is fine if you stay in the present. It's a beautiful life. It's very interesting. You have everything you need. It's just we go into the future, you know, then there's worry. But the more you can just be here, that's a great, to me, that's a great, be here with Ishvara. That's a great nididhyasana. But then, of course, you have to know who Ishvara is. So what is different in terms of meditation for us is that it's meditating upon something we know, not in order to gain knowledge of something that we don't know. So we're not meditating on an unknown. We're meditating on a known and just owning it up. Makes sense. So we'll just do a short meditation. Good. Not too long, because we've had a class. Oh, Terry, you want to get that little thing there? Yeah, that switch. See it? Okay. Yeah, you got it. Thanks. Just gently, just accepting my experiences, whatever they may be right now, just gently change your focus, shift your focus just to your own presence, and doing that, just being with yourself. Notice your freedom from any type of history or any type of change. Just the simplicity of your being. This me, the me that I am, really doesn't do anything at all. It is everything. It doesn't do anything. So let this doership belongs to Ishvara. If I have a dream, whatever happens or is happening in the dream is part and parcel of the whole dream. The story of the dream belongs to the dream. All of the activity in the dream belongs to the dream. The storyline of the dream is way bigger, and it's not coming out of the mind of any individual in the dream. The dream story includes the individual, but does not come out of the individual dream character. So I surrender my notion of doership to the dream, to Ishvara. Letting myself do what is it done? What I'm asked, what is my dharma in a given situation? It has nothing to do with raga dvesha, with likes and dislikes. It has to do with my part in the play. Participate in Ishvara's story like this. I participate as a dream character. I participate in my dream. I'm shifting levels there. It's a dream character. I participate in my dream. When I say my dream, myself is the one from whom the entire dream comes. But myself is the very self of the dream character. So now here, this body, mind, sense organs, I participate in this world, which is my world, which is my story, and this world. I am Jiva, I am Ishwara, from the standpoint of my being. So I, the Jiva, participate in Ishwara's story. I am Ishwara, I am the Jiva. Self from which the whole creation comes. And I'm identified with one jiva within that creation. But the creation is me. Jiva is also me. I surrender to my prarabdha karma, which is Ishwara. Resting my mind, resting in my being, in the wholeness of my being. Give this body, mind, sense organs over to Ishwara. I give it over to Dharma. I welcome my experiences. Myself is an absolute refuge for all experiences.
When you talk about relaxing, are you going to start again?
No.
You talk about relaxing the mind. You can be with me here. You can be, I welcome you. Does that same process affect the Buddhi? Does it become relaxed? Or is it always relaxed?
The Buddhi becomes relaxed when it differentiates itself from the one who's not relaxed. Let's say objectify the one who's hurting, you know, and the Buddhi then takes the position of the one who does the welcoming. The Buddhi is relaxing and has for itself becomes the Atma. Whereas otherwise, the hurt is overwhelming the Buddhi. It's an identification going on there. But the moment you objectify it, and you become the one who is kind, then the Buddhi becomes the spokesperson as though for yourself, because it's objectified the part that is having trouble, right? And so that's the beginning of viveka, of discrimination, is when whatever I can objectify, right, I have a subject-object relationship with them, then I can focus more on the subject. So in the end, Buddhi becomes one who is just like sattva. Sattva means just like a clean mirror that really is only a spokesperson for the Buddhi, because anything other than the sattva that was just mirror-like to your own self is objectified. You know, and so that in that very act, you become, as you do that, you become, your being becomes more dominant. Yourself becomes more dominant because you've objectified the things and come into relationship with the things that, till you do that, you're identified with. And then you take yourself to be the hurt one, or the angry one, or the abused one, or whatever it is. But once you objectify that and come into relationship with it, then the Buddhi is now free of that. And that Buddhi then can welcome the pain. And then that pain is really coming into the sanctuary of your own self, which itself is absolutely free of pain. It's wholeness. It can, any amount, the whole universe of pain, a whole infinite universe of pain can come into the self. The self remains free of pain. Because all of that universe of pain, the universe itself is mithya, it doesn't have any being of its own.
But at that moment, both the mind and the Buddhi are sort of submerged and covered.
When the Buddhi is doing the objectification, the Buddhi is then free. That's why that coming into, even in inner child work, it's the Buddhi that goes in and talks to the little ones inside. Then those little ones have a sane person, a loving person, you know, to be with. And then that's what sets a lot of that affect free, because there's a stable, loving person there that's coming into relationship. So your Buddhi becomes, and the Buddhi is the one that's holding knowledge also. The intellect, the deeper mind. If the Buddhi is, let's say, if you're objectifying, say the one who knows, the one who objectifies everything else, that one, the one who's left as an objectifier, it's still the mind. That's Buddhi.
When the Buddhi is submerged, you can still start in the process.
Yeah. Yeah, like say you're totally identified and overwhelmed with your emotional pain or whatever. Then the Buddhi can say, if it can, eventually it can, if it can't right away, it can say, you're really hurting. You're really hurting. Just by that, now you've set it up.
Yeah.
You're really feeling so much pain right now. Tell me what it is. Tell me what's really going on. And then it'll tell you. You know, your mind and unconscious know much, way more. It has way more to tell you than, but you have to ask. Because otherwise, you know, you're going to get overwhelmed by all that it knows, if you say, like, tell me what's really hurting you, then the mind will go in there and figure that out and tell you. And it'll connect a lot of memories and things, you know, because the problem is usually way more than what's actually going on out here. It doesn't have much to do with it, really. Because the things that are going on here, you can kind of dismiss as this problem and that problem. It doesn't grip you. When it grips you, you know, there's usually some unconscious stuff going on. And then if you ask what it is, it'll tell you. And then if you're kind, if you're gruff, then, you know, that part will feel re-traumatized and kind of just run away again. But if you're coming from the welcoming place, then it's safe. It feels safe to be able to tell you and not go back into its defensive mode, lock itself up in a safe place. Buddhi. And the Buddhi can say, tell me what's really scaring you here. If there's something happening in the world, like some robber is coming after you or something, then Buddhi, let's run. You know, but when it's a psychological thing, you know, then you say, what are you really scared about? Or what's really bothering you here? And you become like a good friend or a teacher. Or a therapist, or a good parent.
Well, to ask that what really bothered you when the Buddhi is lost in the pain of the mind, it sounds like this should be accomplished. You should accomplish that capacity before the process happens.
Well, the thing is that you do, if the mind is hurt, causing you a lot of pain, your buddhi is still, if it's functioning, you know, so that you even remember to do that. But if it's functioning, all it has to do is say, you're really hurting, tell me about it. So there's somebody who cares that comes into relationship with it. And just the fact that a caring part comes into relationship with the hurt part, that is healing for the hurt part. That's how life is. You know, like I say, somebody in the world, and you come as somebody who really cares, and then you be with your friend or whoever that is who's hurt. That is healing to have that, because your presence is healing presence, because you care, you love, you have some love. Or say, if you come and you're negative, then that's further wounding, right? In the world, I mean. So as it is out there, out here, it's in that inside also. You know, you have to find the part of yourself, which is there for all of us. It's loving, caring person. It's not like you'd be dead if you didn't. You couldn't survive as a human being if you didn't know, if you have some love to give to others.
Yeah, I can remember in my late teens. Trying to do psychological work for myself to solve a problem.
Yeah.
And what happened, because I was just feeling very sad and disturbed, and what happened was that you would just sink deeper into that debt.
Yeah. But that's because you didn't know how to go into it. We're talking about somebody who has some knowledge. But even in the psychology world, we teach people how to do this, but you have to go in as a friend,
yeah.
Not as diving in to the hurt as one who's hurt. The one who's hurt is diving deeper into the hurt. So you have to split from that.
And that hurt one says it will unravel this problem.
That's a problem.
That was really a waste of time.
I think it is a waste of time. Yeah. Because the hurt one is not being cared for. The hurt one's trying to solve the hurt problem, but that's not what. Say if you're in therapy and you're trying to do that, but that might work only because of your relationship with the therapist who holds that care and that love. You see?
Oh. Becomes like a booty.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It becomes like the self. But yeah, like the buddhi, like the one that you want to internalize. And in fact, in the therapeutic relationship, the patient does internalize the therapist and provides that ability, you know, that voice. But for us, we're recognizing the constancy of that wholeness that is there as your very being. Yeah, that's one thing you can say. You can also accept having a blue day.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Where you're not trying to push all these feelings away, which makes it worse. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, or getting uptight about it and creating more stress around it. You know, but allowing it to be. If you're allowing it to be in a welcoming way, then the relaxation of the buddhi mitigates the stress and hurt in that mind. That's so powerful about this discrimination, this viveka, you know. It really changes everything. In the end, you don't even need your buddhi anymore because your knowledge is so complete that everything that's happening is happening in the stability of your own presence. Which it is anyway, but that just becomes more and more recognized. And your mind is more attached to the ananda of your own of your own being than to anything out here, than the illusory ananda out here. It's all illusory. Illusory in the sense that you're giving the ananda that is your own nature to something out here as in the form of a projection. The ananda is not illusory, and the objects that you're experiencing are illusory in the sense that they're have a certain empirical reality, but the ananda you're projecting onto it.
But you always do that. You see fullness.
Well, you do until you know. As you know, you don't really seek fullness in the world because you're full. You're owning up the fullness where it actually is. And so the world is fine. You're full, so you don't need to seek fullness in the world because you're full. Like in the Gita, when they talk, you know, in the Gita in India, they dig wells in the middle of rivers in the summer. That's where they'll put the well, you know, because it's always going to, in the winter when the river comes, it'll always really be replenished, you know. So in the summer, you have to go to the well to get the water. But in the winter, you're not going to wade out to the well to get the water. Okay. The verse they have, you just, so I'm not going to wade out there to get some ananda when I'm the river, you know. It makes no sense.
So without knowing where that fullness is, you couldn't really cross it.
No, you couldn't. That's why even when we talk about nididhyasana, it's really based on knowledge. Nididhyasana requires knowledge. And then your clarity builds, you know, in your mind's familiarity and owning it up.
Yeah.
Instead of acting like it doesn't have any knowledge, you know. That nididhyasana strengthens that. knowledge takes place in teaching. We're not talking about knowledge just as some sort of theoretical intellectual book that you read in. You know, it's that you are here and the teaching that you upanishad, and Ishvara is here, the universe is here. The upanishads are systematically pointing these things out for you so that you can actually see it.
So it's and give, a different kind of study, then that doesn't meet the parameters of regular study where you acquire.
You're not having to acquire the experience. The experience is already here. Like say, I have to see that painting, I have to acquire the experience of the painting, and then I can study the painting. But first I have to have the experience of the painting. And that means that I have to bring myself into the vicinity of the painting, and I have to look at the painting. Otherwise, if I don't do that, the experience of the painting is not here. So I have to get the experience of the painting, and then I have to study the experience. But here the experience is always here. It's never not here. You don't have to get the experience. But you need that viveka, that discrimination. Some recognitions have to take place about what is actually here. Experience is already here completely. Yeah. So it's a matter of recognizing.
You really need a good teacher for all that to happen.
You need a teacher who has themselves been taught through that. Because that sampradaya means teacher to student, teacher to student, teacher to student. There's a whole teaching methodology. All these various prakriyas, these teaching methodologies that are handed down. It's like they use the example of one candle lighting another, and that flame just keeps being passed down, you know? So it's not that the teaching is that difficult, it's just that you have to have received it to give it. In some ways, it's like in knowledge is something that's passed on. Yeah. It's kind of a neat thing. Sure, I mean, you can sit in, but it's all the same, though. Every moment that I'm opening up my knowledge and seeing it, that is nididhyasana. So we can sit and just have sitting practice, which is nice because I'm just not involved in the world and I'm just giving myself that time. That's a beautiful thing. But it's happening continually in class. Nididhyasana happens continually in class every time you see. So that when you're studying, it happens. When in the world, when you're bringing your mind back, just recognizing Ishvara, recognizing your own self, it could happen in a split second. You know, so you have to see nididhyasana as something bigger than just sitting in meditation. Studying a text can be nididhyasana. See, you're studying a Upanishad or something, but as you study it, you keep seeing. There's moments of seeing in nididhyasana. In one text, Martananda was talking, just like I'm talking now, he was talking like this. Swamiji's talked like this when he is taught Aparokshana Bhuti. And at other times also, but I know where he's really sitting with this way of understanding Nididhyasana, which is the truth of it, really. Otherwise, it's way too constrictive.
What's the derivation of
that? I'm not sure. It's got to be duplication. In it. Yeah, but this is nididhyasana. I have to look that up. I was just thinking about that too.
Yeah.
Nididhyasana. Ni is an upasarga, it's a preposition. And nididhyasana. I have to look it up. Yeah. Next week. I'll give you the whole thing with etymology of nididhyasana.
It's like going to the next episode.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure I knew that at one time, but I was thinking of it now. What is that etymology?
Well, it just makes you more familiar with it.
Mm-hmm. I don't know.
And Tippy wants to know too. She has a...
Tippy's in the... Oh, she's sound asleep in the corner.
She's in the whole class. Yeah.
That is an honor that she's here in class with us.
Yeah.
I know. And there's the heater. She doesn't want it in the cold room up there. Yeah. What a good girl she is.
I've never seen her feel so safe.
Yeah. Yeah, she's really looking good. Sweet girl. She's been hanging out in here all day today. It's been a pleasure. And it's my favorite thing. Okay.
And when she saw that I had the intention to take me to the
bathroom,
she told me so.
And that's her little spot. So be just sleep there all night when it's cold like this. Yeah, I sleep on the couch. I sleep with her. Don't really. I like to be in here. Yeah. I could go in bed whenever I want to, but I don't always.
We're going to have a few more classes like this, right?
We're going to have three classes like this. Let's say our prayer. Swasti Pajabhya Paripalipam Nyayena Margena Mahim Mahishaha Go Brahmane Bhyashkupamastu Nityam Loka Samasta Sukhino Bhavantu Kale Varshatu Parjanyaha Prithivi Sasya Shalini Desho Yam Kshobarahitaha Brahmana Santu Nirbhayaha Om Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinaha Sarve Santu Niramayaha Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu Ma Kaschid Dukha Bhag Bhavet Asato Ma Sadgamaya Tamaso Ma Jyotirgamaya Mrityorma Amritangamaya Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om